I tend to think that, you know, these are two sides of the same coin. It's not something where you fight one with the other, because if you fight one with the other, you just get the same result. You repeatedly cycle through. You're not addressing any kind of material, because the opposite of wokeness, again, is just, you know, individualism and
when
you look at the anti-woke people, it's always the same like conservative nonsense, which it goes to the same place.
See, that was my stance a few years ago, and now I think, oh wait a minute, maybe I do have to be anti-woke after all.
The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Diet Soap is a Sublation Media podcast.
All right, Peter Coffin, you are the guest today. You are a longtime YouTuber. You're as gray as I am, but you're about 20 years younger. And
yeah, it started when I was 16, so I've been blessed with the do you dye your hair? Looks like they think that it looks good, because like people think, I used to go into coffee shops and be like, do you dye your hair? And I'd be like, nope.
Yeah,
it's lucky.
Yeah, when I got to be around 40, I got a big this streak here in my hair. Mm-hmm. And a barista who was about 25 said, oh, I love your hair, it looks so nice. And I'm like, yeah,
it's the coffee shops.
I like, it comes with a price. Okay, I'm 40 years old. So anyway, yeah, Peter Coffin, you are, I think of you as a YouTuber. I think of you as a partner to the Annoying Orange. But also,
yeah.
I think of you as a lefty YouTuber who's had an interesting path.
I have walked an interesting line.
Yeah, starting as a pretty conventional bread tuber, I would say. No offense to you. And then ending up writing this book here, Woke Ouroboros, which we're going to be talking about today. But before we dive into this, I want to ask you about what the hell you've been doing on Twitter lately and what's going on between you and H Bomber Guy. Am I missing this? It seems like, okay, did the person that, just tell me the story. What's going on?
And the damage it can do. The piles of money people make from stealing other people's words and ideas and work. But there's one group more important than historians or journalists or anyone else with a real job, and that's gay people. You know what's worse than stealing from established journalists who in the end are doing okay? Stealing from small queer writers or creators from marginalized groups who weren't even paid for their work in the first place. Stealing from the writings of dead people who passed away doing the activism you pretend to do. Stealing from the very people who fund your videos, the people you claim to be defending. This video is about James Summerton.
Okay, so
drama. Spill the tea.
Back. It may or may not be tea per se, but back in December, H Bomber Guy released a video called Plagiarism in YouTube. It's a 4-hour video detailing a lot of individuals and their personal wrongdoings in terms of plagiarism. Mm-hmm. And it actually specifically discourages any systemic solutions or criticism during the course of the video. Like I'm not even saying like he implies it. There's a point where he actually goes, I don't want to advocate for any systemic solutions. It's so during the course of it, there's a lot of people that he talks about, but there's a particular individual named James Summerton, mm-hmm. who his content isn't particularly for me. I don't really particularly enjoy it or anything like that. But he hones in on this individual and he kind of paints him as incompatible with civil society because of his plagiarism crimes. Mm-hmm. He advocates for his deplatforming, for his removal of income. And after posting the video on his subreddit, H-Bomber Guy's producer coordinated basically a naughty and nice list of plagiarists and queer creators to follow on YouTube, which is more or less coordinating harassment of your various plagiarists. Mm-hmm. And over the course of several months, I put out a documentary very recently, which the Plato is a Bitch, AI and Bomber Guy. I put out pamphlet versions of all my documentaries. But that's about how the concern itself is more or less an ethical justification for intellectual property law and thus bourgeois property dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also at the same time talked a lot about how all of this harassment, all of this like hounding this guy who's apologized several times, said he was in the hospital for having committed self-harm over the course of it. I've said that this is going to end in him possibly killing himself. And I think it was Sunday, he posted, it might have been Sunday or Monday, I can't remember exactly. Excuse me for not having the exact right date. But he posted what appears to be a suicide note, and nobody's heard from him since.
Still, I thought that there had been a breaking news or something, but no one's heard from him.
No, that is the thing that came up was from his ex-writing partner saying he didn't think that there was anything going on, which is, in my opinion, a vague note, and also not. It's not necessarily something where I think like we need to all definitely believe that he's dead. But I also like we don't know. The way I look at it, it's not responsible to say that he is A, dead. I think he's potentially dead. But B, I mean, there is at least cause for some hope that he's not dead. They think mm-hmm. that it's not it's obviously not good if this man committed suicide. No. I don't think whether his
obviously
for me or not.
Obviously not.
So I've essentially, you know, I compared it to, I don't know if you remember this. I think you may, because you're out in Portland, right?
Mm-hmm.
You may have actually been closer to have heard hearing about this, but there's a marathon runner a few years ago who got caught cheating and they hounded him. It was West Coast. I don't think it was Portland. It may have been Seattle, if I remember right. But they hounded him for cheating for months, and he killed himself. Like it wasn't mm-hmm. ambiguous. And I compared the James Somerton thing to that. And I did that in a video that I uploaded the day before he posted this suicide note. So it's mm-hmm. like, I mean, it's to me, it looks bad. It's bad. This guy, he's the result, not necessarily, I don't want to say like he is dead, but if he is dead, it is the result of a harassment campaign that's been going on since early December, which has been coordinated by a guy who wants to point at individuals rather than at systemic problems, which is ultimately like he, during the course of this plagiarism video, talks about how the cause of plagiarism is people's lack of meaning or their God hole or whatever. And it's not, he explicitly says like it may be partially, you know, financial incentives, but it's not really, it's about the God hole. And it's like, no, I think it's probably more about the financial incentives than it is any, I think you can get success quicker that way, mm-hmm. but
let's talk. There's two kind of stories here. One is about plagiarism and the other is about cancel culture and kind of this mob mentality and this, we used to have call out culture, the call out. It used to be call out culture,
and before that, it was just, I think, plain old accountability. I don't know. Yeah, right. Like, that word has stuck around, though.
Yeah. So there's two questions. One is, do you want to settle disputes about plagiarism or anything else through calling out cancellation, harassing mob justice online. And we can talk about that. Anyway. And that's the thing in itself. I don't, right? No. But then the other thing is the plagiarism thing itself. I mean, like I make a lot of videos, okay? And no. I make a lot of videos with a lot of quotations. And who knows? Maybe there are times in there where attribution isn't perfect. Fully there. Yeah, right? You know, like...
No, like I have to work to attribute quotes correctly as well. It's not always an exact science.
Right. I don't know that I've ever done that, but I wouldn't put it past me, you know, to have made that mistake. The other thing is at Zero Books, there was I'm not going to name the title, but people probably know there was a very big title that we had that had a couple lines in it that actually were pretty much lifted from Wikipedia. It was a paragraph that was just trying to describe a set of facts and it was not just like this happened on this day in this location with these people. And it was just copy paste out of Wikipedia. Pretty close. But I think that was done. Again, it was one of those things like, this is kind of a modern note taking. I'll copy and paste. And then, it ends up, you forget what you wrote and what you didn't ends up in the book. And people made a big stink about it. It got written up in the Daily Beast. The author was very shaken by it. And I had to, as a publisher, I had to release a statement. And what I said was, look, it's Wikipedia. We didn't violate anyone else's copyright. We're not getting sued. We don't have a deep pockets for fact checking. We have a copy editors, but we didn't run a plagiarism check on it. So, you know, if there's a new edition, we'll correct it. Otherwise, though, it's still a good book and it's just a couple of lines. We're not that concerned about it. And over right now,
made people mad.
It did. It was like, that's very flip. And I said, well, whatever. I said, if you look through the catalog, there are typos and problems in almost every book. The most popular book at Zero Books at the time, Capitalist Realism, the first edition, riddled with typos and errors, you know?
Oh, because the first edition of my Custom Reality and You was like, my ex-partner brought it up to me. And it's like, are all the typos like part of the joke? Like, I'm like, No.
All right. So So the thing is, we're in this media culture now where desktop publishing and now desktop everything and phone everything makes it easier and easier to produce media with a smaller and smaller budgets. As the budgets are disappearing for mainstream media, they don't, you know, it's harder and harder. So, and then we have you throw in ChatGPT and AI, these are plagiarism machines, right? So, and YouTube also, you know, you can get hit a copyright strike.
Oh, I know all about copyright strikes on YouTube.
Right. You can get a copyright problem, demonetized or a copyright strike for using a clip of music or maybe some imagery, but
stuff you could read entirely within your right to use.
You could read an entirety of a book aloud. And if you're copying someone who's already got an audiobook, yeah, maybe that will get you. But if you're just reading a book, no one's going to come at you for a copyright. And also, there is such a thing as called fair use when it comes to educational content. So what is the big crime here that this guy committed? I mean, maybe it would be better if he did give attribution, but he's not robbing anyone else
that I make in my Plato documentary is that creativity isn't really so much pulling some new thing out of the ether. It is instead combining a lot of your life experience and your you know, I make the case. I don't know if you are familiar with Austin Kleon's Steal Like an Artist.
No, I should be, I guess. But
it's
anyway.
It's good. I would definitely highly recommend. It's not Marxist or anything, but he's spot on with what creativity is. I make a similar case to him, which is that he doesn't say this, but I ultimately come to the idea that creativity is ultimately editing. It's making creative choices about things that you're aware of. That's essentially what creativity is. And to me, even if you were to word for word copy down somebody else's words, if you're saying it into a camera or you're performing it in some way or you're putting visuals with it, those all carry with them some form of authorial intent. They do something to the content. The way that you say a word has an effect on the way the word is taken. Like, these are all elements of the human experience we sort of imbue into things that we repeat, even word for word. Like, and most of the time people don't repeat everything word for word, and it's not really something that you have to worry about defending. Like, a lot of the time people just, you know, summarize. Like, recently James Summerton put up a video that was, it had a ton of cited, he cited everything down to his stock footage. Like, I think that that's dumb, and I think that's an overuse of citation. But he did that, and what H-Bomb came back at him with was, this is just an aggregate of other content. It's like, well, what do you do? What is a video essay? What, like, you pretending like you brought something new to the idea of plagiarism discourse? Like, what all you did was just review crap that you looked up elsewhere. Like, you didn't even really do anything new here, you know? It's just, it's aggregating
it. So why is H-Bomber guy doing, what is the motivation for H-Bomber guy to go on this tear, do you think?
I think there's a couple of motivations. I think the reason why I incorporated into a documentary about Plato is I think that it harkens back to sort of Platonic elitism. Like, he sees himself as a philosopher king. He even says it on his Twitter. It's a nice little joke on his Twitter that he's a philosopher king. If you go to his profile, it says it still. I think that there's a kind of elitism where he sees himself among the upper echelons. And I think that real creators versus fake creators, which I call in these people's minds consumers in sheep's clothing, so to speak, who are people who are just regurgitating information, they're not being creative. I think there's an elitist thing. And I think that there is an underlying, which is a more Marxist motivation at play. I think that we're seeing very saturated markets, attention economies on YouTube. And I think that this, maybe not consciously, but to some extent, is some way to knock some competition out and make it slightly easier to put out a video and be sure that it's going to get attention.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, I've never been part of the BreadTube scene. I have friends who are on YouTube, but I feel like there was this YouTube scene, right? You'd watch it on the Rewind videos or something. And these PewDiePie and I don't know, Jacksepticeye or whatever his name is. And these people that are big name YouTubers, and they all know each other and they all have parties. And I don't know, they rub their bits together or whatever they're doing. And then and I've never been invited to that party. And I also didn't ever necessarily want to be in that party because I'm from a different, more, look, I'm wearing tweed. I'm not a YouTuber.
Yeah, you've got a tweed jacket on.
All right.
I've at least got a Portland hoodie on.
Yeah. But in any case, I feel like there was this YouTube community, and there was a hierarchy within YouTube, and it had to do with how many subscribers you had, and how much money you were making and how many people were watching you. And there was a similarity between them all that were at that level. But I feel like, oh, you know, this is coming after a bunch of the big ones have quit. Right.
Which I think is actually part of the same incentive I was mentioning. I talk about this there's a lot. I would highly recommend watching my Plato documentary.
Yeah, watch the Plato documentary. And is it on? It's on YouTube.
Yeah, YouTube. It's on the channel. Very Important Documentaries.
All right, Very Important Documentaries. I'll link to it. I feel as though there's a saturation. You're right, absolutely right. The YouTube, there for a number of different reasons, seems to have been, it's just become a much more difficult place to succeed in. Absolutely. Even for people who are already super successful, they're seeing a decline. I think there's two major reasons for it. For political YouTube, there's one major reason for it. But there are two major reasons for it. Otherwise, shorts is eating. It seems to me now. I people debate this, and maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like Shorts is eating YouTube.
I think yes, and I think that that's partially correct and it's partially incorrect. I think the correct thing is that I think that a lot of people's time gets sucked into that. But I will also say I think that Shorts, to some extent, are feeding. I'm noticing Shorts are feeding my subscribers on my main channel, not on my documentary channel, but like there's nuance, but I think you're correct about that in a lot of ways.
Well, so, okay. So what I mean by it, and maybe you can correct me, this would be worthwhile for me. I don't know if the audience is going to love this so much, but the Shorts.
Let's talk about how statistics affect YouTube's economy.
Yeah. As people are doing this for a living, and that's a part of the company, you know, for me, it's a part of the publishing books. Sure. We have a magazine, but it's definitely a big part of what we do, making a podcast and doing YouTube. It seems like Shorts gets a lot of the views of YouTube. People spend a lot of time in YouTube. I don't know if the total views of YouTube have expanded because of Shorts or if they've been divided, but it seems like they've expanded, but not as much as they would have for long form content because of short form content, the Shorts. Also, though, the relationship that people have to the things they watch on YouTube is entirely different because of Shorts. Shorts blend together. You're just flipping by and it's all one thing. They're not different. The channels are not that important on Shorts.
Yes.
So because of the TikTok mentality that's taken over. So now you may be huge on Shorts and not have that many subscribers for your channel altogether. And
correct.
Your long form content may not be outperforming mine. Even you have a million viewers on your Shorts or something like that. So all of that means that it's harder to make money on YouTube, and overall the whole total media environment is just maxed out. All these streaming services have purchased way too much content. Everyone rushed in to create a streaming service more than anybody could subscribe to. And people are now no longer locked in their homes. You know, it's a couple of years since that. I definitely think that.
I think in a lot of ways you're looking at a repeat of a crisis of overproduction type situation. And the response, what you're seeing with Shorts, I think it's very astute that you said the amount of views are not changing. That's 100% true, because there's only so much time in a day and there's only so many people who watch YouTube. It's a lot of people, but there's only so many of them. And what you end up with here, in my opinion, the famous YouTubers quitting or scaling back is what I'm calling the sad degrowth response. And the H-bomb response, I'm calling the mad degrowth response. They're attempting to find ways to degrow the market in order to have room to operate within it. Now, I don't know that I would say that they're consciously attempting to do that, but that I think is kind of the, if you're talking about material incentives, like you have an oversaturated market, people have a limited amount of time. Okay, how do we get past this? Okay, we could plagiarize and we could make our content faster, or we could scale back the amount of content, or we could try to attack people who are plagiarizing and get them off the platform. Like, these all ultimately, I think, address the problem of a saturated market.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And by the way, you know, one of the things that we're looking at right now is we're going to launch a bunch of new channels.
Because all of which are going to be plagiarized.
No. But which means we're not necessarily going to do more videos. Right. We're going to do.
See, videos. That's smart. I think that's very smart.
Doug is very, very smart. Doug is very, very smart. Doug is very, very smart.
I could do this insider baseball through the whole thing. Yeah, we're not going to do that. We're going to stop. Instead, maybe I'll cut a little bit of that out, but
that's fine.
All right, let's talk about your book but I do think I want to blend the two topics together, because
I don't think you're wrong to do that, because I think there's a lot
Right. Wokeness, wokeness and the media environment and the media's oversaturation and the segmentation of the market. There seem like it's all connected somehow.
I think that it very much is. Like if you talk about intersectionality, for instance, I think that, you know, the way it's described is all of these various strings meeting together in the middle. And that's the individual. But I would argue that seeing things that way results in groups of people splitting along those lines more so than it results in us analyzing an individual from a specific standpoint, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that also the woke approach to analysis became maybe one of the ways in which the mainstream media tried to have a overall ideology that it could stand behind. It would, so, you know, it used to be, you know, you might have a liberal channel and conservative, but that was kind of cracking up. And so well, things like Vice and BuzzFeed and Cracked. Remember Cracked?
I do remember Cracked. All three of those sites all started off way more interesting than they ended off.
Right. Right. Cracked. I used to subscribe or at least pick up copies of Cracked magazine when I was a kid. Because, you know, Cracked was like the off-brand Mad magazine.
Future is already pretty strange in the way that making out with your mom is pretty strange.
It's so.
But the strangeness becomes much more pronounced if Marty is a girl. And that's without digging into the young woman sneaking out late at night to conduct experiments with an old man. So let's blast Martha's sweet ass to the past and see how that makes us feel. Because I'm curious if it remains a beloved family movie classic that's also the go-to film for both screenwriting classes and useless substitute teachers looking to kill a couple hours.
Back to wokeness. So we have Cracked, we have College Humor, we have all these things that they all ended up going hyper-woke. At least... maybe College Humor less than the others, but some of them
to some extent, at least.
Yeah, Vice,
I would say.
And it was a way to, first of all, it was an easy way to generate content, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it was also a way to give the viewer a sense that there was a moral cause involved. But do you think that wokeness primarily became a big thing because there were financial incentives and it was an easy because of the content economy that we're in? Or do you think that there were other reasons that generated the woke ideology?
I think there's a large aspect of it. Yes. I think that answering no to that would be a big mistake, because in terms of content, when you create an ideology and can, first off, the first book I put out, I talked about something called cultivated identity a lot. You place a commodity at the center of people's identity and you can really make it easy. Now, they commodified this woke ideology. They made it into a thing. You can buy it in a million different ways. You can buy it either figuratively. You can say, I buy it. I buy into this ideology. You can buy a billion books, including my own book.
Right.
But you also have the incentive of like DEI programs bringing in ways to manage liabilities, like you know, in my opinion, a diversity, equity, and inclusion program, which is, you know, a large component of wokeness, like these things are means to outline areas of concern for a corporation. In the same way, like they do it in the normal human relations HR mode, and they find new problems, they find things to deal with, and it's more or less means to avoid liabilities, avoid lawsuits in the long term. And it also deters unionization, because they're addressing these types of issues that would normally be brought by some form of worker collective or worker power as concerns. Instead, they address them via seminars that are mandatory or meetings, either in groups or one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
Our man.
Look, see, there's your cat.
Coming in to really mess up the train of thought there. But it's
so there's economic incentives in terms of creating content in this oversaturated market. There's also the motivation from corporations to avoid liability, and this is a very easy way to do it by defining. Basically, you define problems around harassment in a particular way, give the trainings to address it, you know, very deeply to get to the systemic problem. And then you can wash your hands of it, and anything that happens is the fault of the employees, not the fault of the company itself, because they've done the due diligence. So that's all true.
And a lot of it is also the social mode that these types of these trainings and meetings perpetuate, which is a kind of a segregation, a social mode. Like, to be completely clear, I see the DEI stuff often as highlighting differences and making it so that you're not allowed to address what is a perceived difference from that point forward, which ultimately causes people to self-segregate to at least some extent.
Right, which is fine, because you just want them to come in, do their job.
Sure.
Stay out of trouble, keep their noses clean, go home. Don't get us into
that's exactly why you want them not to be talking. You want them to be segregated. You don't want them talking to each other.
Not if they talk to each other, they might unionize as well. Exactly. I mean, it's good.
It could be just a problem if they talk to each other.
Yeah, in a variety of ways. So let's get.
So let's maybe tell them that there's something different about that race that makes it so you can't talk to them.
Right. That sounds good. And also, you know, if there are some, you know, resentments that have built up between the races. Sure. And if they mingle, they might get into a conflict and somebody might yell something at somebody else. And then that's a problem for us. But if we train them not to, then it's a problem for them. And if we really do a good job, they won't do that. So that's good too. Yeah. So that's all true. But the thing that I want to get at here is that it seems like wokeness has gotten to another level now. And there was a time, like a couple of years back, where I was like, okay, yes, I'm not for wokeness. I think the intersectionality and wokeness, they accomplish far less than they think they're accomplishing. It's clearly not sufficient. This is not socialism. It's not what I think of the left as being about. But I'm not like going to define my politics around being anti-woke.
Sure.
Because then you get slotted in to this. That's just the flip side of the same market demographic.
Well, there you go. Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly what it is. There's a chapter in my book called Idealistic Criticism of Wokeness, which I think addresses this. I don't explicitly say it in that chapter, but I think that anti-wokeness and wokeness are just two sides of the same coin. That's kind of the implication of the Ouroboros thing. Like, I think that, if wokeness is a reactionary ideology that ultimately finds progressive sounding ways to reinforce old power differentials, then how is it that different from anti-wokeness other than aesthetically speaking? I mean, there are ways that it is aesthetically different than anti-wokeness, obviously. To say I don't want racism is different than the way some people will frame their anti-wokeness, because there are very racist people that exist in the world. That's not something that doesn't exist. But I tend to think that, you know, these are two sides of the same coin. It's not something where you fight one with the other, because if you fight one with the other, you just get the same result. You repeatedly cycle through. You're not addressing any kind of material, because the opposite of wokeness, again, is just, you know, individualism and when you look at the anti-woke people, it's always the same like conservative nonsense, which it goes to the same place.
See, I that was my stance a few years ago, and now I think, oh wait a minute, maybe I do have to be anti-woke after all.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please do consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons help to make sure that Sublation Media can continue to provide interviews, videos, books, and articles that are critical of the left from the left. If you are tired of remaining stuck within bourgeois ideologies and politics, help us sublate them both.